Hey everyone, and welcome to Tales from the Booth, Roland Garros 2024, round three. I just like to say it that way. I don't know why. It just feels right. And this is the last Tales from the Booth. I've just wrapped up my final day of commentary this morning, so I won't get to say it again for another year. Assuming that I do the same thing next year, the concept, for those unaware, is that I call matches first week of Roland Garros, so it's a lot easier for me. And the only thing that's possible for me from a time standpoint is to talk about the matches that I called. It worked out way better last year. This year, for various reasons, it just wasn't that simple. Last two mornings, I've been calling doubles, so not going to talk about the doubles matches. And with the rain, it's also kind of complicated things. It's been tough. The 3 a.m. finish last night made it so that I couldn't post after round three immediately like I wanted to, so we have half the fourth round matches done on both the men's and the women's side. But what is going to be preserved about the Tales from the Booth format for sure here, even though I won't be talking about the matches that I called, is more quick-hitting stuff, big-picture stuff, free-flowing, loosey-goosey, a lot of different topics. The only one I'll really go long on is Djokovic-Musetti. But other than that, I'm going to keep it moving. I'm going to hit on Arnaldi beating Rublev, the alcohol ban, Medvedev-Mahac, Alcaraz stuff. I watched the quarter match. I couldn't watch the FAA match this morning. Zverev-Griekspoor fifth set. And those are the big ones. And then I'll talk about the draw in general. In fact, I'll start with that. One thought on doubles. I just want to get this off my chest because it's been on my mind. I just think it's not in a good place from a intrigue standpoint, and I just don't know how sustainable this is. If we continue to go on this path, because I do feel like the interest in doubles has kind of continuously decayed in the last 20, 30 years, and I say that with the caveat and the acknowledgement that I haven't really been around 20, 30 years to really observe this. In terms of, especially if you go more towards the 30 range, I haven't been around. But I know the top players used to play doubles, and that obviously takes care of itself when that happens, when the top singles players play doubles. But then I think there was an era, even after the top players stopped playing doubles, where you did have a level of familiarity and continuity with teams like the Bryan Bros, and Nestor Knowles, and Nestor Zimonjic, and I'm sure I'm missing some, where I do think that you kind of had enough there to kind of sustain a little bit of, oh, okay, we know these people. You know, rivalries are built. Teams are kind of learned. And I just don't think there's any of that right now. None. Especially in men's doubles, because I would say some of that has been preserved on the women's side, especially at the very top with Krejcikova, Siniaková, and now Goff and Goff-Pegula, and now Goff-Siniaková are actually playing together for the first time at this year's RG. They'll probably win the title, if I were to guess. I just wanted to say that. All right, what are we looking at as a whole? On the women's side, you have Sabalenka, Swiatek, Goff, and Rybakina all in. They're all still in. Less surprising or more expected on the men's side. Not that at any point it's felt shocking, but it has gone kind of contrary to the narrative coming into the tournament, which was always a strong possibility. If you weren't getting kind of swept up in it all, like I even said in the preview, and look, I didn't think that among the top three, Djokovic, Nadal, Alcaraz, I didn't think it would work out for all of them, but I did think it'd work out for one or two of them, you know? At least one of them I thought was going to just be okay and play their best. And when it comes to the concerns that we had coming in about all three of them, I would say all three of them have, you know, not to say that they're going to win their next match or that they're going to make the semis and make the final or whatever, right? It's yet to be seen what's going to happen. But as far as concern about Sinner's hip, concern about Alcaraz's forearm, concern about Djokovic's ability to compete and play with emotion and fire. Like, if those were the three main concerns, in my opinion, they were, Well, those have all been put to rest. You also have, as a whole, on the men's side, you have 12 out of the 16 seeds making the round of 16. Everyone in the top five, 13 of the top 14 in the ATP rankings made the fourth round. Incredible, right? The one who didn't is Arnold, is Rublev. So let me, just because it's topical, let me hit that right away. Especially because I'm not going to go too in-depth because it was a morning match, which means I couldn't watch it. There were these viral Rublev meltdowns. It was bad. I'm sure most of you have seen it. In fact, it was so bad that I think it kind of left the inner tennis bubble, and these videos were kind of getting passed around the internet because non-tennis fans who didn't even know who Andrei Rublev were in maybe a somewhat messed up way amused by it. Not that I blame them, not that you're a bad person if you are amused by it, but obviously I think if you actually feel more of a connection and you care more about Andrei Rublev, you probably feel differently. Thinking that it's funny is probably not your primary emotion if you care a lot about Andrei. But it kind of confirms that we're in the same place post-Dubai. You know, there hasn't been any real reckoning there. I think it's safe to say that. But even more concerning, it feels like when he did try to rein it in, he couldn't win tennis matches. So it's a very tricky place with Andrei. He continues to also show this extreme awareness, like this self-awareness about it after the match, to the point where what he said afterwards was so eloquent that it's something that I would almost use in the future, which is he said that because of his emotional outburst throughout the match, I, quote, gave my opponent wings. That is such a good way to describe the negative effects of melting down on court. It's a great way to describe to young players, especially kids who are known to do this all the time, hey, you're hurting yourself because you're helping your opponent. There's a surface thing with Andrei also that I want to point out. It's kind of interesting. His Masters 1000s are on clay. Monte Carlo, Madrid. But since 2020, if you look at what he's done at the majors, failed to make the second week three times in Paris. That's by far his most upset-prone slam. I know the sample size we're looking at here isn't huge, but since 2020, that's the time sample that we're using here. It's happened once in Australia. It's never happened at Wimbledon, although he has missed two Wimbledons since 2020, so he's only played it twice. And it's happened once at the U.S. Open. Paris, it's happened three times. I find that interesting. I don't think surface matters that much with Rublev in general. The only thing matchup-wise that I always kind of flag with Andrei in serving friendly conditions against big servers, I think he does struggle in that situation. And in that way, I think clay helps him because he does just make more returns in play, which can be a problem. But other than that, surface with Rublev, it's kind of a shoulder shrug to me. I feel like he's fine on all the surfaces, and it's pretty much even. Matteo Arnaldi, I think I've gassed him up quite a bit this year. You guys know I'm high on him. Again, I can't really speak to the match. I did talk to people who watched the match, and it sounds like Arnaldi had a great forehand day, and he can really move the ball through the court with that forehand. And on clay, especially when he has a little bit of extra time, heavy RPM, tons of speed, it is a monster forehand. But I think also compared to Rublev, or I heard, he was much more dynamic moving back, defending, turning points around. One of the main themes, and I'm going to talk about it as I go through these matches, the conditions with the temperatures that and the humidity have been unbelievably slow. The clay has been wet. It has been freezing cold. So it's been tough to be offensive and to finish points or to get a lot out of your serve. Like, all these things have been really hard. And I think Rublev was having trouble getting it through the court. Not only was Arnaldi more dynamic defending, but it sounds like his forehand was a total monster throughout the match. And it looks like he had chances to go up 2-0 against Tsitsipas. Stefanos won a tight second set tiebreak. So good stuff from Arnaldi. Great week, and we'll see if he builds on this. He probably will. Let's get to Djokovic Musetti now. Main event of this week's Tales from the Booth. And of course, because of the scheduling decision, I was not able to talk about this last night, which would have been good. I don't understand the scheduling decision. It makes so little sense to me that I don't even know how to formulate an argument against it, because I don't understand the logic that was implemented in the first place that led to putting Zizou Bergs versus Grigor Dimitrov on Court Philippe Chatrier late at night, like in a time slot that was obviously going to double up, essentially make for a double best of five set night session on Chatrier. Like, I don't know what the logic was, so I don't even know how to argue against it, other than to say that the outcome of Djokovic and Arnaldi playing ridiculously late was not just predictable, but inevitable. And I don't know why you would go out of your way when you have other options, clearly, because there are other courts that you could have Dimitrov and Bergs play on. Why would you do that when you have the option to not do that? Ultimately, Djokovic comes back from down 2-1, wins in five. And if we're just going back to the Djokovic outlook coming into the tournament, you understand very vividly why this is such a meaningful win for Djokovic, because it's exactly what he hasn't really been able to do this year up to this point. And obviously throughout his career, we've gotten to the point where we expect Djokovic, regardless of how bad the first set is or how badly he's being outplayed for a stretch of 1 hour, you expect two things. You expect problem solving. You expect a lot of fight. You expect the level to raise under pressure. And all of these things have kind of been missing. But here, Djokovic digs deep. He fights through adversity. There's a lot of reasons for him to fold or shrink from the lateness. Like, the fact that not only are you down 2-1, you're down 2-1 and it's 1:30 in the morning. The physicality was not easy for him. He suffered out there, and he said it after the match. Like, he had to put himself into the red physically, and if he wasn't willing to do that, he would have had major issues trying to win this match. He didn't have the confidence that he normally has to kind of lean on, which is a big part of being resilient in tennis, is to lean on memories. Just be like, think about the Roland Garros final when he's down 2-love to Tsitsipas. What could he have done after the second set? 2-love down. Hey, I was there last week. Last week I came back from 2-love down. So, you know, that obviously helps belief. It helps resilience. Novak this year hasn't really had that. And then obviously the problems that his opponent was presenting. Musetti, it's hard to say. Look, I think in a lot of ways he is a tough matchup for Djokovic. I also think that Novak just happens to play him at Roland Garros and Monte Carlo for the most part. And Lorenzo is much better when the pressure is off, underdog mentality, super slow clay. So Novak, when he plays Musetti, super slow clay, underdog mentality, they've played a lot of tight matches. When they've played on hard court, it hasn't been close. It hasn't been competitive at all. So I don't know if I would say straight up that Djokovic is, you know, has trouble with the Musetti matchup. But I would say when they play at the French Open or Monte Carlo, you feel like Musetti's going to be in the match and have a chance to win. So between the lateness and the physicality and the lack of results and the problems his opponents were presenting and the history with his opponent, it was just really impressive mentally for Djokovic. And for the first time in a while, we could say that he kind of did the Novak thing and figured out a way to win when it was looking kind of unlikely. And it really became about will at a certain point. It looked like there was a moment in the fourth where he got the break of serve. Honestly, the body language at the start of the fourth set wasn't great. And at that point, I didn't have a lot of confidence just because of the physical stuff I was seeing, but mostly just because of the body language. I was a little bit concerned. I didn't really think he was going to win the match. He gets the break in the fourth, flips a switch. And from there, I think he, you know, it seemed like he decided he was going to play every point like it was his last, and things got really good. Quality throughout the match was pretty high. I thought the tennis was good, and Djokovic looked sharp like 90% of the time. But it was also really noticeable, well, besides the third set where there was a physical dip, but it was also really noticeable that he was suffering more than Musetti in the long rallies. And I'm going to kind of start by talking about why Musetti was able to go up 2-1, and then I'll get into the next part, which is Djokovic kind of taking over for the next two sets. So I thought it was clear really early on that Musetti had a cardiovascular endurance advantage. You could see the visual cues of that just with the heaviness of the breathing, right? Look after a long rally. Watch after a long rally. Just look at Musetti's shoulders. Look at how open his mouth is. And then see the same thing with Novak. And it was very clear, right? With Novak, you had wide open mouth, shoulders going up and down, and Musetti looked fine half the time. So I noticed that early. And then you saw during the points, increasingly, that Djokovic was going to these fatigued drop shot attempts and occasionally some desperate net rushing where he didn't really do enough damage to kind of find an opportunity to come in. But he clearly wanted some points to end, usually with the drop shot, sometimes with the net rushing. And that was creating chances for Musetti. I don't think Novak is a cardio beast anymore. Obviously, he used to be. There are still people who push back on me. Like, somebody asked me on Twitter what's going on, and I kind of explained some of what I'm about to explain. And I did get some pushback on the cardio thing because, I mean, we're so used to the Novak Djokovic 2011 through 2018 or something like that. I'd say that's the range where Djokovic had the best cardio in the world out of any tennis player. Rivaled by Nadal and Murray, but, you know, rivaled by Ferrer, I'd say. But basically the best cardio in the world. Just hasn't been the case in recent years. People struggle to kind of adjust the thinking on that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't want to be too arrogant about it. But in my opinion, he's not a cardio beast anymore. And right now, it's probably even worse than it usually is because of the struggles that he's had this year overall, particularly the struggles that he has been open about when it comes to just putting in the work every day. But he usually, and throughout the last few years, he has fully gotten away with whatever losses in cardio he suffered in this post-prime, post-physical prime era. He's gotten away with it because he's still usually the better tennis player. Actually, always, the better tennis player on the court. And he's adapted his game to make cardio less important, a less important piece of the puzzle. So that's why he's able to still win tennis matches. You know, this is not a cardio contest. This is a tennis contest. This is a tennis match. You don't always have to have the better cardio to win. In fact, I don't think it decides a lot of matches, if we're being quite honest. So it takes a unique set of circumstances for Novak to not get away with the cardio deficit that he sometimes has compared to his opponent. This match sort of had all the circumstances that made it important. Freezing cold night, outdoor clay, slow as can be. Now, I don't know if this helped him or hurt him. I think tactically, it hurt him a ton. Because in better serving conditions and in easier penetrating conditions, his serve plus one offense and his attacking style against Musetti is way more effective. And Lorenzo's defense has much less of a say if the conditions were quicker. So tactically, it hurt a ton. Physically, it might have helped, because I'll also say that in the third set, when it looked like Djokovic had lost a lot physically, I was thinking, geez, what if this were a hot day? Like, it's really cold and cool, and it still feels like Novak is kind of paying a price. And normally, the nighttime conditions help him physically quite a bit. So that's what I would say about the conditions. But as far as cardio mattering a lot, the court slowing down makes cardio more important. And then you have Musetti just playing elite defense. Totally elite. Just awesome with his slice defense and his defensive lobs. And Lorenzo, he's a quick guy. He's got good speed. He definitely likes to back up deep behind the baseline, which definitely makes it harder to hit through him. But man, like, speed in itself does not make you great defensively. What Musetti was doing to be great defensively was what he was doing when he got to the ball. And that is a terrific understanding of how height can be an asset, how taking off pace can be an asset when defending. So he was taking all the pace off, maintaining depth, you know, sometimes doing it with the, you know, high topspin kind of loopy shot, sometimes doing it with the floating slice defense. But when you take all the pace away and you're able to maintain depth, you give yourself time to recover position and you make Djokovic generate all his own pace. And as long as you kind of keep him far enough away from the middle of the court, or as long as you keep him deep enough in the court, in these conditions against Musetti's speed, it was tough for Djokovic off of that zero pace high ball through the middle to finish Musetti. Now, the one thing about the defensive lobs that Musetti was throwing up constantly is he did surrender a lot of overheads. But Novak was having a little bit of trouble putting them away. Now, the good news is Djokovic actually didn't miss a lot of overheads. Novak was hitting the overheads somewhat clean, but directionally, he was very challenged. They were oftentimes much too central, and then sometimes when he did pick a spot, Musetti was reading it really well, or Novak just wasn't able to see in his peripheral vision where on the court Lorenzo was, and he'd end up hitting it right at him. So I kind of made a joke on Twitter about this as well. It just felt like Djokovic never hit a winner on an overhead. And then late in the fifth set, he hit one winner on an overhead, and it was like, that was new. That was a new one. We haven't seen that. So that was kind of obviously the trade-off with every time you're on defense, if you're just throwing the ball high up in the air, which is what Musetti was doing, the trade-off is your opponent might take some balls out of the air and potentially hit some overheads. And for Musetti, that trade-off just wasn't hurting him because he was even defending overheads. When Novak was coming forward, Musetti's shot-making on passing shots were terrific. When Novak was drop-shotting, Musetti was covering it extremely well, especially once he realized that it was probably coming after like 12 or so shots consistently. Novak started to get less predictable on it because he was combating his fatigue in the rallies with drop shots. So here's the picture I'm painting. Finishing issues for Djokovic, when drop shots aren't all that effective, when net rushing isn't all that effective, when you're not getting it through the slow conditions, when you don't have any pace to work with and Musetti is in good position, you have finishing issues plus cardio issues. That equals problem. Musetti won a ton of big points scrambling. He benefited from a slowed down Novak after, you know, the long points piled up. He took advantage of premature droppers and net approaches. And that was kind of the formula for Lorenzo, who was also aggressive. You know, I don't want to act like aggression wasn't a big part of Musetti's game. I think it was. But what stood out was that not only could Musetti have success when he was dictating, that's pretty normal in a tennis match. So that didn't really stand out, although it was happening at times. You would expect it to happen. What you wouldn't expect to happen is for Musetti to win a lot of points when Novak is dictating. But it was happening. Fourth set. I think the big adjustment for Novak was he started controlling play earlier on. preserving his gas tank by keeping Musetti under pressure on his side of the net. And it just felt like Novak was doing a lot more standing in the middle of the court, dictating, not getting pushed around. And that was helping his legs. I also thought he simplified his offense a bit. Less drop shots, more selective net rushing. Take the ball earlier, hit the forehand big into precise locations. And the forehand, like, it worked out for him. Because I think if you look really carefully at the start of the fourth set, especially, and, you know, everything was clicking in the fifth. So that's the part of the match that I really like to look at, the start of the fourth set, what was happening there. I think the forehand really turned it on in a way that it hadn't all match long. It was the MVP of that beginning of the fourth set stretch where Djokovic ended up shifting the momentum. He actually started missing his forehand less, even though his aggression maybe went up, which is obviously a pretty ideal combination to have. But I think it was simplifying the offense, more aggressive off of the return of serve. So another thing was Musetti was kind of kicking his second serve in at speeds that are pretty below average, especially nowadays, like 90 mile per hour second serves. And I think starting in the fourth set, Novak was like, I'm not going to just let you do that. Like, I'm going to stand way inside the baseline and take it really early and aggressive. Like, I can't let you play a neutral rally if you're going to serve like that. I'm going to take control right away. That was a good adjustment. I thought that he rushed Musetti on the backhand a lot in the last two sets. And, like, I saw Musetti slicing in situations where he's kind of forced into it. So he's deep in the court, he's rushed, Djokovic is up on the baseline, and Musetti is slicing from that position. That's very different from the kind of slice that I actually think works for Musetti against Djokovic in this matchup, which is when Lorenzo is kind of tighter in on the baseline, and he's able to hit a shorter, more biting slice. And when he does that, it's actually a great play against Novak. Gets Djokovic to hit up on his cross-court backhand. Musetti is pretty great on the backhand down the line if he has a weak enough ball to do it on, or he can go forehand inside in. And that's a great combination for Lorenzo. Totally different story when he's backed up behind the baseline, hitting up on a backhand slice that kind of floats a lot more. And also Djokovic is so far inside the court that he's going to be able to position himself as far as his footwork is concerned much better versus if he's a little bit more pushed back because Musetti is up in the court ahead of the rally and he's hitting a backhand slice from a more favorable position, either neutral or offensive. And that's where Novak, if he's further behind the baseline, he's actually having to get up to the ball, move inside the court, try to get up to the ball, and ultimately probably hit from a lower contact point. And also hit more backhands and less forehands. In this case, on this more floating slice, when Musetti is pushed back, Novak has tons of time to take a forehand, no matter where the ball lands on the court. Even if it's way in the backhand quarter, Novak has more time to get a forehand. On Musetti's side, I don't think he dropped off a total cliff until the fifth set. But the shot-making and defensive magic from Lorenzo did seem to disappear. So the passing shots, I saw a lot in the fourth set that weren't landing. Were they easy passing shots? No. Would I say they were like terrible mistakes? No. But do I feel like he was making it in the second and the third set? Yeah. Was it easier for Novak to get forced errors? Was the defense like... did it lose like 15% quality? I think so. Yeah. It just felt like there were more forced errors where second and third and the first set, by the way, it just seemed like if Musetti got his racket on it, it was coming back in the court, you know, like pretty much every time. I do want to point out some stats before I kind of wrap this up. So more effective offense is what we're focusing on here. That's kind of what I'm drilling down. Well, net points won, sets 2 and 3 for Djokovic, 14 of 30, that's 47%. Sets 4 and 5, 20 for 26, that's 77%. So net points efficiency totally skyrocketed. And then winners. Winners, sets 2 and 3, 27 of 15 for Musetti. Sets 4 and 5, 17 to 16 for Djokovic. One thing that I want to mention mentally, I talked about Djokovic mentally already, but heading into a fifth, if you're Lorenzo Musetti, you have a lot of baggage in that situation. You have the 2021 match where you were up 2-1 and you lose to Novak, you retire in the fifth set. You end up kind of taking a lot of heat for it in a way that I think Musetti is like a pretty sensitive guy. And I think that affected him a lot, the backlash. I don't think he handled that all too well. Young kid, sensitive guy, totally understandable. But I do think that was a part of the whole experience for him in the match. Not only losing in a painful manner, but then also getting like reprimanded by a lot of people online. Musetti has lost at the previous two majors from up 2-1. And I don't think that should be discounted. When he was up 2-1, going into a fifth set, he was like, ah, damn, this happened in Australia to me. This happened at the U.S. Open to me. Is it going to happen again? And then the five-set record overall, it was 2-6. Now it's 2-7. So kind of speaks for itself. Tough spot for Musetti with the mental baggage. It was just hard to imagine Musetti playing the level that he did earlier going into the fifth set. And it was hard to imagine Novak not continuing to raise his. All right, let's take a quick break from the tennis. Talk about this alcohol ban. And just a fun fact, I hit the mute button at this point in the podcast, the first go around, and I didn't realize. So I did the next 30 minutes, all my other topics with the microphone on mute. So this is round two. I want to talk about this alcohol ban. It shocked me. And I'm very curious to read comments about this because I'm quite certain that there are some cultural differences when it comes to the relationship between alcohol and sporting events. I can tell you that in the United States, where I'm from, the relationship is a very strong one. Sporting events, alcohol consumption, those two things go together for a lot of people. And I don't doubt that in other places, it might not be as strong. But for that reason, this was pretty hard to wrap my head around, especially as someone who goes to the U.S. Open every year and sees what a big part alcohol plays in the U.S. Open experience. And if you took alcohol away from that, it would change it a lot in the sense of who would be interested in coming to the U.S. Open. Because the way it goes right now is a lot of non-tennis fans, people who do not watch the other three majors, do not watch ATP WT events during the year, they go to the U.S. Open. And I tell them to. I tell anybody who will listen in my life, doesn't matter if you like tennis or not, come to the U.S. Open. You are going to love it. And they do. And they do. You take alcohol away? I think it's a little bit different for a lot of those people. Just saying. So that's kind of the first thing in terms of where I land. But also what I don't like about this is it reinforces every negative stereotype that keeps people away from our sport. That it's lame, white collar, prim and pop proper, a country club sport, self-serious, no fun, stuffy. Like all of these things are, to me, not what tennis is about. To me, misconceptions, molds that I think tennis is best served to break. And when there are headlines across the world that says Roland Garros bans alcohol, like, do I think it's going to have a significant reputation on the way tennis as a sport is perceived? No, let's not go crazy. But I think in this microcosm, I do think it kind of looks that way. It plays out that way when you're saying the crowds, they've been too much. So no alcohol is allowed in the stadiums because the crowds have been too much. Well, have they? Because I know one thing happened that was disgusting. David Goffin got spit on. It's not okay. And there should be accountability for that person. And that is usually how sporting events that I am familiar with operate. When somebody misbehaves, there is accountability for that person. They are removed. They are usually, as they did something bad, they are banned for life. Never allowed to return to that specific venue. There was that incident, and then there was Iga, who asked for more quiet during the point. There was only one time that I specifically noticed her bothered by the crowd during the match, and that was on a ball where she hit an approach shot. It looked like it was going to be a winner, but Osaka miraculously got there, made Iga play an extra ball, and the crowd at that point was making a lot of noise during Swiatek's drive volley. Clearly that bothered her. Enough for her to ask, very politely, I might add, with a lot of qualifiers in front of it that I actually have a lot of respect for. She asked very politely that in the future, the crowds be careful not to make noise during the point. Which, of course, is a request that has no chance of working or being effective. But, you know, I'm not trying to criticize Iga for it, because if she wants to say that, all the power to her. I just find it ineffective, and I also don't think that she has much of a case that the crowd was being unreasonably noisy at any point, or disrespectful, or intentionally disruptive. I mean, none of those things were true. What happened on that specific point were people who were excited about the match and excited about what they were seeing naturally having a reaction that they couldn't quite contain. And that was ended up translating into volume. And look, the expectation of silence in tennis is what makes noise distracting. Paula Badoso, when she was asked about this, thought it was interesting what she said. She said, Iga's complaining on Chatrier? Man, try playing on court 14. Not a direct quote, but essentially that's what she said. Because it's true. On the outer courts, these players are playing next to walkways and corridors, and there are courts next to courts, and you have chair umpires from the court over calling the score. You have crowds on the court over reacting to the points happening in the other match. You may have music playing not too far away. It's not quiet out there, but there's no expectation of quiet, so you're not distracted by it. And for me, the Iga situation was an example of if Osaka makes a miraculous get, you can expect some people in the crowd to make a little bit of noise. It should be an expectation. Just like when the ball hits the back of the line in the middle of the point, usually that draws some murmurs as long as the crowd is engaged to a certain level. And it's just human nature. Like, I would love to say everybody do better. Everybody just shut up. Anybody should be able to be silent during a tennis match. Ideally, sure. Wimbledon, they do a pretty good job. I just think it's kind of the culture and the way people behave there is a little bit elevated. But if it's not like that, do I think that's a problem? Do I agree with Iga that that's a problem? Do I agree with Iga that that's worth a PSA or complaining about? No. But again, she can say that. Where I really have an issue is the overreaction. The overreaction by Emil Moresmo. The spitting incident was bad. That person should get accountability. I don't think there is any problem with the crowd in the Swiatek Osaka match from where I was sitting. And I know I was watching through the television screen, and maybe I missed some stuff here and there, but these microphones are pretty darn good. I feel like I could get a sense. I also am going to acknowledge that I've never been that man in the arena or that woman in the arena. I've never been there. I've never played on center court at a slam. I don't know what it's like. What I can say is I've watched countless players take what Iga dealt with in stride without being bothered, just going on about their business. I've watched countless players do that. I can also tell you that the morning after this incident, Swiatek saying what she said and the alcohol ban, I was in a room with three former top 100 players. None of them were sympathetic towards Iga's complaint or request. None of them agreed with the alcohol ban. So I know for a fact, this isn't me, you know, necessarily just completely lacking perspective and not understanding how hard it is for a player. Well, that may be true. I don't understand what it's like to be out there. I also know that, again, there are plenty of players who see it the way I see it. I'm going to leave it at that. All right, Medvedev-Mahach is a match that I want to talk about because I thought it was amazing to watch. Look, roof closed, 90% humidity, cool temps, as we've been talking about. So they were playing tons of neutral rallies, and there was just amazing pure ball striking on display with a lot of variety, too. Both of them were kind of doing it in different ways. But what this was the match that, to me, the slowness of the conditions were the most striking because I felt both of them were kind of crushing the ball, and it just wasn't doing much. So that goes two ways, right? Either someone finds creativity offensively, whether that be with their net rushing or their drop shotting or opening up angles in a particular way, either it goes that way or it goes the way of the more consistent player wins or the more physical player wins. Like, it's going to be one of them. And the way I look at that match, creativity, kind of a tie. Medvedev used the drop shot really well. That was a good way that he added some extra offense to find a way to finish points in the conditions. What Mahach was doing was extreme directional variety. So constant change of directions. Whenever he got the chance to change direction, he did. And that was making Medvedev move quite a bit. And I think that the fact that he was going down the line so often was a form of variety in itself, because whether it be on his backhand or his forehand, it was 50-50 directionally. And I don't have the stats, so maybe I'm wrong, but it felt 50-50. You never knew which way he was going. And that, to me, is a form of creativity. Where Medvedev found the advantage was consistency. Oh, and physically, both of them held up beautifully. So nothing between them physically. Creativity, just about equal. Consistency kind of tilted the scales for Medvedev, particularly in the first set tiebreak. And it continued to kind of make the difference. I think these conditions are pretty awesome for Medvedev as well. I think he likes it when the clay is wet and the ball is not bouncing as high. He moves better on it. It's not as slippery for him. And look, he doesn't get the benefit of that super lively bounce that takes heavy topspin so well and makes it go kaboom off the court like a Casper Ruud forehand. Medvedev doesn't get that benefit. So he's on a more even footing with his opponent if nobody's getting that benefit. I also think that Medvedev's serve is slowly coming on. Seems like he's getting healthier and healthier. That's good to see. Continue to track that because it feels like the shoulder issue, he's starting to sort that out and start to serve better. Now, Mahach, let me talk about him in general quickly because he's pretty unreal. His pace generation on the backhand, for someone who is under 6'3" and has a two-hander, is pound for pound as big as I've ever seen. He can create offense from the back of the court with a two-hander like nobody's business. And he gets plenty on the forehand too, but that's more normal. That's not where he separates himself. The backhand, to me, jumps out. I talked about how often he was going down the line in this match. Most players who try to do that will struggle. It's hard. You need impeccable timing. Mahach really has that. And anytime he gets a half chance, it must be so stressful playing against him, because when he gets a half chance to redirect the ball, he does every single time. He is also very athletic, and he uses his athleticism in a variety of ways, not just for defense. He is really good at closing the net, really good at covering the net. He's very aggressive with his footwork when he looks to take time away on short balls. And I think he's excellent sliding into his forehand and still getting a lot of juice on the tennis ball. Great quality to have on clay. I don't think he's quite at Tsitsipas levels, but he's in that ballpark, which is a huge positive. So just wanted to say all those things about Mahach. Probably a top 20 watch for me on tour. Moving on to Carlos Alcaraz. So I watched his match against Sebastian Korda. I thought tactically the most interesting thing about that match was how often Korda was coming into the net and the degree of success he was having. There were lots of crucial points for Korda that he was serving volleying on. And it did not go well for him. And I think the way I probably said that at the start, it probably sounded like Korda had a lot of success at net. I actually mean the opposite. There was a lack of success at net, even though it was a real pillar of his game plan was coming forward against Carlitos. He ended up, for the match, 23 of 42 at net, which is a 55% mark, which, you know my stance, especially if you've been listening to my channel and my show for a while. 55% net points won, that's a losing percentage because it's a slice of points where you're in an offensive position, a good position to win it. You should be winning far more than 55% of your net points. Now, my takeaway from this was not Korda isn't good at net. Korda needs to work on his volleys. Korda's fine at net. Korda's a pretty good volleyer, definitely above average. My takeaway from this was more net rushing Alcaraz on clay seems crazy hard to do. It is harder to damage him on approach shots. He loves a target. He's going to cover your volleys with high-end speed unlike any other. If you volley deep, good luck. You're not going to finish the point that way. If you volley short, you have a better chance of finding a finish. But if he gets there, his hands are incredible. So now you've dragged him into a cat and mouse situation where he excels. So I don't know. Like, I've seen actually a lot of players net rush Alcaraz on a frequent basis and do well on it, right? Like Tommy Paul, for example, has done really well with it. It just looked like Korda on slow clay, it looked too tough, in my opinion. Now, I didn't know at the time watching, I didn't really think Korda had much of a choice. So I wasn't really critical of the tactics because the conditions were so slow. I don't think Korda had that high-end power to just blast right through these snail conditions. But in hindsight, Seb was 22. Seb, in 9-plus rallies, 9 shots or more, Alcaraz won 22, Korda won 21. So it was totally pretty much even in the extended exchanges in this match. So maybe it would have been better for Korda to be more selective coming forward, apply pressure from the baseline, hope to force more errors out of Alcaraz, and if you get neutralized, which you're going to if you stay back, deal with it. The penalty for getting neutralized if you stay back is the point is neutral. That's your penalty. The penalty for getting neutralized at net is usually you lose the point. So that part was interesting. You know, the whole like Korda coming in all the time and kind of having trouble with it, including on the serve and volley. Now, Alcaraz in general, what's really stood out to me is his discipline, his shot selection. I think it's been awesome. It's been Indian Wells-like. He's doing a great job, and this is going to sound familiar. It's exactly what I said after Indian Wells. He's doing a great job of building points with high margin, heavy forehands. That means lots of height and lots of spin on his rally ball. Use that to earn the short ball, earn the weaker ball. Then you can inject pace, flatten the ball out, hit to more ambitious and aggressive targets. Step one, step two, in that order. The version of Alcaraz that Juan Carlos Ferrero has been trying to turn the page on, that I have been at times critical of, is the Alcaraz that skips step one and goes right to step two. We're going to bludgeon the forehand. We haven't earned that short ball. We haven't worked the point to try to gain an advantage. So there's the decision-making aspect of it, and then there's the aspect of it that when Alcaraz did look to inject pace, he looked 100% doing so for the first time, where wasn't holding back, swinging through the forehand with everything he has, producing insane speeds without hesitation. So from a health standpoint, honestly, I'm going to use the 100 number here because that's what it looked like, 100%. For Korda, by the way, not a bad match. More fiery than usual, which I love from him. I want him to be more fiery. Forehand was pretty solid, which was kind of the main concern last year for me. And lastly, he's added a lot of speed on the serve, but not enough to be a factor in this match, which is going to transition me to the FAA match, which I do want to go quickly on because I didn't watch, but the stats really do say a lot about how the match went. Felix, his serve plus one wasn't effective at all. If you look at the points on his serve in 1 through 4 shot rallies, he won 28, Alcaraz won 23. Rarely should Alcaraz be winning quick points when Felix just hit a serve. That makes sense, right? It just shouldn't happen very often. For Felix, considering all the first serve damage that he needs to do to stay to be successful, all of the plus one forehand damage that he needs to do to be successful, considering he only won that rally subset 28-23, tells you all you need to know. Zero aces for the match, 57% first serves in, and 24 forehand on forced errors. Again, serve forehand player, serve didn't look all that good statistically. Forehand wasn't all that good statistically. That's a problem. But Alcaraz's return of serve does look really good. And this is two guys in a row now in Korda and Alcaraz who have above average serves on tour. And he has neutralized it to a large extent. Overall, man, Alcaraz looks better than anybody else. Like, I'm willing to say that. I think that's the truth. Haven't seen much of Tsitsipas because he's played in the morning so often, but, you know, I'm willing to say that. Does that mean the world? No, it definitely doesn't mean the world. Look at what happened at the Australian Open. Not one person would have told you that Alcaraz, let me rephrase this. Not one person would have told you that Zverev was playing better tennis than Alcaraz through 4 matches at the Australian Open. Nobody, not a soul would have told you that Zverev was playing better. But they played in the quarterfinal. Zverev won the match. That's how tennis goes sometimes. But Alcaraz does look the best. Speaking of Zverev, he gets into a battle with Talon Griekspoor. Now, I mostly just watched the fifth set, but I did get snippets and, you know, I got doses of the match before the fifth set. And it was interesting to see Griekspoor's serve and volley just so effective. And ultimately, it comes down to someone executing at a very high level. Spot serving from Griekspoor, excellent. Percentage first serving from Griekspoor, excellent. Volley execution, I've always thought that Griekspoor is an awesome volleyer who's very smooth transitioning to the net. He's not the most athletic guy from the baseline, but suddenly when he comes forward, he starts looking a lot more athletic. Plus, you know, you hit a slider serve out wide on the deuce side. And Zverev, he's standing pretty deep. He's hitting a forehand return, and you're asking him to be aggressive on it. And you're probably also shading the cross court. I don't know, like, that sounds pretty good to me. That is making Zverev leave his comfort zone. He's not an aggressive returner. So now you're making him hit an aggressive return on the wing that he's less reliable being aggressive on, especially if the ball stays low, which it may have been given the conditions of the clay at the time. You know, make him hit up on that ball a little bit, take away the cross court, and now Zverev has to redirect forehand returns down the line. I mean, it seems like a play that makes a lot of sense, and it's something to track. Now, Rune, usually, he actually likes to serve and volley a lot, but usually he kicks to the backhand on the serve and volley. I'm just curious to see if they look at that match and they say, okay, we're not going to do it like Griekspoor and do it all the time, but we should do it sometimes. Something to track. Now, as far as the fifth set is concerned, there were some really bad moments for Zverev. I mean, first game of the fifth, the second serve goes away and has a little bit of a moment. He double faults. He hits an absolute, like, powder puff second serve on the next point that was short in the box and probably like 75 miles per hour, like a Yeah, just a second serve that needs to be demolished. And Griegsborg demolished it and won the point. And there was a game earlier in the match where Zverev double faulted three times in one game. So there were flashes with the Zverev second serve in this match. It hasn't happened very often recently, where it did look like he was thinking about it quite a bit. Griegsborg was down love 40 in the next game, ended up consolidating the break by making five first serves in a row, instant offense with a couple of serve and volley, service winners, came forward off of his, actually wasn't a plus one, it was a plus two, but really good stuff from Griegsborg to consolidate. So far, so good. Then in the next game, he hits a really good backhand slice pass. He hits a really good backhand slice cross court that makes Zverev hit up on a backhand. I think Griegsborg on the next ball plays a forehand inside in to win the point. So I thought the slice backhand, which is another excellent shot of Griegsborg's, contributed to him getting another break in the fifth set. And suddenly, it's 4-1. From there, it might have been 4-love even. I don't know if it was 4-love or 4-1. I think it was 4-love, actually. But it would end up being 4-1. Griegsborg serves at 4-1. And the wheels fall off, He couldn't handle the moment, I think it's fair to say, because he just got really sloppy. He made three unforced errors off the ground and missed a routine volley after an overhead that he couldn't finish. That was the 4-1 game. Just an ugly, ugly game. 4-3 game, he actually played a couple of good points, so at least he did that, but ultimately, he double faulted twice, and he missed two first ball backhands. One was off of a deep return by Zverev, and he framed the backhand. The other was off of a very average return by Zverev, and he just kind of hit a naked, tight backhand miss. So the service games by Griegsborg were bad. He stabilized, got it to a fifth set tiebreak. Zverev earned the fifth set tiebreak a lot more. Zverev played very well, hit some good aggressive forehands. Griegsborg lacking some finishing touch on a couple of the crucial pivotal moments, but I really don't want to get too much into the fifth set tiebreak and the details of it all. I do want to point out a pattern for Zverev, which is this cockroach quality that he has in the first week of slams. He will get into five setters with players who, on paper, he should beat more easily. He just never seems to lose those matches. Look at his five set record round by round. First round, 6-1. Second round, 8-0. Third round, 3-3. All the losses are 2018 or earlier, though. So this was a third round win over Griegsborg. So it was actually his first five-set third rounder in a while. Round of 16, 3-2, still good. After that, it falls off. So quarterfinals or further, he's 1-4 in five setters. Better players, it should fall off a little bit, but there's certainly an extreme drop-off and an extreme efficiency in the first couple rounds where he gets in five setters quite a bit and just always seems to win them. Lastly, on Griegsborg, I hope this doesn't linger for him because it is one of those matches. It could. It was that level of painful, I think, for a guy who has never beaten a top five player and, more importantly, is yet to make the second week of a major. Now, the good news is matches like this, they don't normally linger. One match usually doesn't do it. The bad news is we've seen it before. Bojic van de Zandschulp, who I've been thinking about this week because after he lost his first round match at Roland Garros, he kind of hinted at retirement, said he's really just not enjoying himself out there anymore. And you can kind of trace it all back to the Bojic van de Zandschulp, the Holger Rune Munich final, where he was up 5-1 in the third set and blew that lead, going for his first career ATP title, has not looked the same since then. And then the other example that I would say is Francis Tiafoe, who I think emotionally, body language-wise, he hasn't looked the same since losing to Shelton at the U.S. Open quarterfinal last year, which, as it was a very weird match mentally because Shelton just seemed to suck the energy right out of Francis. And I think Francis was really kind of surprised by how that match went and what happened. But that was another example where sometimes a match can linger for whatever reason, and hopefully that doesn't happen with Griegsborg. That's all I got. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time. Test.